Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A, and welcome to Midday. Before we start today, we're going to be speaking with the terrific author Will Haygood about a wonderful book about the Black soldier's experience in the Vietnam War. But before we get to Mr. Haygood and that book, I do want to let you know about a pretty surprising announcement that was made this morning by the superintendent of Baltimore County Schools, Miriam Rogers. Has announced that she is going to retire from that position as the superintendent of Baltimore County Schools. This is reported in the Baltimore Banner by Kristen Griffith, our good friend who covers education. Ms. Rogers has a year or so left on her contract. She was hired in 2023. Her predecessor, Darrell Williams, stepped down under some controversy. Baltimore County has done quite well in terms of test scores under Dr. Rogers' tutelage. They received the most five-star school ratings from the state of Maryland and the Maryland Report Card for the second year in a row. But Miriam Rogers did not leave or did not mention a particular reason for her leaving her post as the superintendent with a year left on her contract. She simply said, "It's been an honor to serve," and she's no longer going to be the superintendent of Baltimore County Public Schools. So two jurisdictions, Baltimore City and Baltimore County, will have, one assumes by next year, a new superintendent, Sonia Sonalesis. Dr. Sonia Sonalesis, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools, will be leaving at the end of June, at the end of this school year. She has taken a position at Yale University in an institute that studies education and pedagogy, and so she will be leaving. That has been known for quite a while. There's a search committee out that is working as we speak, trying to find her successor. She's one of the longest-serving superintendents or CEOs of school systems certainly in the history of Baltimore, and one of the longest serving in the history of the country. I think there's only one other person, a person in Ohio, who has served more than the 10 years that Dr. Sonia Sonalesis has served. Again, Dr. Miriam Rogers, the superintendent of Baltimore County Public Schools, has announced that she will be retiring in July. She sent an email to parents in Baltimore County. And so we'll keep you posted on the doings when it comes to finding a new school superintendent for the county school system. Again, when it comes to the Maryland Report Card, Baltimore County Schools has done fairly well. So one would assume it will be a very sought-after job, and they'll get a lot of good candidates, one hopes. And we will keep you posted here on Midday about finding a replacement for Dr. Miriam Rogers, the outgoing superintendent of Baltimore Public Schools. So today, as Black History Month comes to a close, my first guest is Will Haygood. He's an award-winning journalist and the author of 10 nonfiction books, including a best-selling biography of Thurgood Marshall and a biography of Eugene Allen, a White House butler and the subject of a popular movie, The Butler, by Lee Daniels. His latest book is a compelling history of the Vietnam War, told by Black military personnel and others, who help us understand the war through the lens of race and inequality. It's called The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. Will Haygood and I will discuss this book next Tuesday night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library, and I am delighted to welcome him to Midday today. He joins us on Zoom. Will Haygood, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So I wonder if we could start by having you run the numbers. You say right at the beginning of the book that Black soldiers were sent to the front lines in Vietnam and died in a disproportionate way to white soldiers. Tell us what's behind that assertion.
You know, there were many draft boards across the country, and unfortunately, truthfully, they were about 97% white during the time of the Vietnam War. So if you were a young Black recruit or you felt you were going to be recruited and you had some kind of ailment or illness and you thought you had a good reason to not have to go to the military service, it was a good chance that you were going to be turned down. So there were more young blacks drafted proportionately to the number of blacks in the American population. So you had, once in Vietnam, you had 50% of the soldiers sent to the front line who were black, you know, and so it was that black soldiers were carrying the heavy end of the log in the early going of the war.
And black soldiers were either enlisting or being conscripted. Tell us about Project 100,000, which was a brainy idea from Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. And as you write early in the book, it quickly became Project 400,000. But Project 100,000 was designed to increase the number of soldiers in general, but it ended up increasing the number of black soldiers in particular. How did it work?
Yes. This was a sad program when you look back at it, because it told judges throughout the country that if they had young men who were about to be sentenced to prison for nonviolent crimes, like maybe 1 to 3 years, the U.S. government would give them an option. They could go to prison or they could go to the armed services. Now, the young men who were accepted into that program also were accepted with lower scores, lower aptitude scores, lower test scores. They would not have gotten admitted into the armed services with those kind of test scores. So you would have somebody who came maybe from a poor segregated school who wasn't, how can I sensitively say this? They weren't smart enough to go off to war. They were young. They had already gotten in trouble. And now they were being sent to boot camp rather than prison. And then 2 months later, they would find themselves in a war zone shooting at people.
Yeah, and they actually lowered the standard of the test scores, right? It used to be you had to pass about 30% of the questions, 30 out of 100, and they lowered that to 10 to be able to scoop up people, and they allowed people with criminal interactions and, you know, interactions with the justice system to basically enlist or go to jail. They gave them that kind of decision to make. So it was, and this didn't only apply to black soldiers. There were white soldiers as well. But it was about 41% of the people brought in under Project 100,000 were black. What were the consequences for this kind of recruiting for the military on the battlefield itself? How did it work, as a practical matter, fighting in Vietnam?
Not very well. A whole lot of disciplinary problems from these soldiers. And one can understand why. And of course, many were shell-shocked, and many landed over in Vietnam, and within 1 to 2 months started saying to themselves, I should have gone to prison. This is rough over here. People are shooting at me. Friends are dying left and right. And my mom is worried about me. My siblings are worried about me. It was all around a terrible situation. But Southern segregationist senators, who Lyndon Johnson felt that he needed for certain bills, they loved the program because there were a lot of young black guys suddenly being zapped out of Memphis, Tennessee, or St. Louis, or Philadelphia, or Baltimore. They were suddenly gone. So you had tens of thousands of young blacks who were gone out of the neighborhoods. And that was sad. I mean, because look, if you're 17, 18, 19 years old, and if you're at home and you're a young man, Asian, Hispanic, black, white, and if your sister, let's say she's at the swimming pool or she's at a party, the mother in the house might look to the son to go pick up their sister or to protect their sister during walks home from school. If the young man, 18, 19 years old, was absent from the household, then there was a less layer of protection.
Yeah, those neighborhoods, those neighborhoods were decimated of young men. And of course, that decimation continued well after the Vietnam War. People talk about the school to prison pipeline.
Yes,
many
Tom,
years
you're right.
After the Vietnam War, where again, there are neighborhoods where, you know, huge numbers, sometimes majorities of the young black men in these neighborhoods weren't there. They weren't living there because they were in jail. And in fact, you write about black soldiers returning from, black and white soldiers returning from Vietnam with heroin addictions.
Yes.
And that landed a lot of those folks in prison once they got back anyway.
Whole lot of problems like that. And I think, you know, one of the seminal moments stateside during the Vietnam War was Marvin Gaye's album, What's Going On. And he sat in a room and wrote that album. And because his brother, Frankie Gaye, had gone to Vietnam and had come back to Michigan with serious problems, mental problems. You know, that was a seminal album, a seminal song. Brother, brother, what's going on? Brother, brother, there's too many of us dying. War is not the answer. Only love can conquer hate.
You know? and you write about that, comparing it to some of the other, you know, pivotal, seminal moments in American history, in black history. Jesse Owens at the 1936 Olympics, Marian Anderson and her concert at the Lincoln Memorial, which was 1939, well before the war. But novels like Richard Wright's Native Son, the establishment of Jet Magazine, these, you know, pivotal moments. And you say that even up with Thurgood Marshall's appointment to the Supreme Court, that Marvin Gaye's record in 1971, What's Going On, is as important a moment in black history. I thought that was a really interesting observation.
Yes. I mean, I just think that those singers, you know, wanted to get a bead on the Vietnam War. You know, this was the nation's first racially integrated war. It was not your father's war. And so you had soldiers, young black soldiers, intent on not being treated as second-class citizens. And so they took the anger of the streets and the agitation on the streets, they transported it to Vietnam. And so that's what happened. I mean, these young men had heard Malcolm X, had heard Martin Luther King Jr., knew a lot about how unfair black soldiers were treated in World War II. And so they wanted to get respect. And so there were a lot of confrontations. I mean, you would be out in the battlefield and you would be fighting, and your fellow soldiers who were white were your friends while you were fighting. And you were their friends because everybody wanted to get back home. But back at the base camp, a black soldier could go into his tent and go to sleep and wake up and see a Confederate flag that had been planted in front of his tent during the night, obviously by one of the white soldiers who he had been fighting next to.
Yeah, the paradoxes are just amazing. And we'll talk about some of the racial incidents that happened not only here at home on military bases, but even in prisons and other places in Vietnam itself. We'll talk about that on the other side of a quick break with Will Haygood. His latest book is The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. You can send us an email as well at midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, Dr. Carla Hayden will be the guest host here on Midday. The former Librarian of Congress and former CEO of the Enoch Pratt Library will speak with Chad Helton, one of her successors at the Pratt. He is the Pratt's current CEO. And Dr. Hayden will have many other guests as well, talking about all things literary for Black History Month tomorrow here on Midday. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is the author and journalist Will Haygood. We're talking about his latest book. I really enjoyed it. It's called The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. We'll be in conversation about the book at the Pratt Central Library Tuesday night. You are welcome to join our conversation today. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. So, Will, I'm fascinated by your exploration and chronicling of what's known as a DAP, D-A-P. It's a fist bump. And sometimes a more elaborate way of shaking hands with people, different grips and finger snapping and that kind of stuff. I never knew that DAP, I never knew there was a name for that kind of handshake, first of all. And then secondly, never knew that DAP is an acronym for dignity and pride. But there were people, actually, as far the military went as far as court-martialing people for greeting each other with a DAP and a particular kind of, you know, shall we call it Afrocentric handshake. Tell us about that.
Well, it was sort of a takeoff movement when he was at the 1968 Games and raised his arm, and he had that balled fist. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. At
he,
the Olympics.
That balled
yeah.
fist, and then that went all around the world, and that was sort of symbolic of Black power. And the Black soldiers wanted to communicate with each other kind of in silence. And so deep, you know, and so when they would greet each other, they would do this handshake. Now, white military officers thought that it was some kind of secret code, and that maybe Blacks were planning to attack them. It was great paranoia on the part of military officers when they would see Black soldiers doing a handshake like that. And but it brought Black soldiers together. If you were from St. Louis and another Black was from Harlem and another Black was from L.A., Watts, they all knew the DAP secret handshake. And it would bring them instantly together. But it was seen as a subversive move on the parts of white military leaders.
Yeah, and Tommy Smith, John Carlos, the athletes at the 68 Mexico City Olympics were certainly front and center in that conversation. But some of the other activists, Stokely Carmichael, for example, said, you know, I'm not going to Vietnam. Nobody in North Vietnam has ever called me the N-word. You know, you had Muhammad Ali, you know, refusing to serve because, again, of the racism that he and you know, black communities across the country experienced here. But when it comes to something, it seems as simple as this, you know, DAP, this certain kind of handshake, there was a 4-day riot in 1971 in Northern California at Travis Air Force Base. So it happened there. And also, there was actually a prison in Vietnam called the Long Dinh Prison that was a prison for American soldiers who were absent without leave or who had made committed other infractions. Tell us about what happened at the Long Dinh Prison. This is a story that certainly I was not familiar with, and just, you know, fascinated to hear that this was happening in Southeast Asia itself.
Yes. In that prison, Tom, at some point, sometimes it was as much as 85% black. And so you could imagine simply that black soldiers were being disciplined more harshly than white soldiers. Circling back to Stokely Carmichael, he had a quote that was very powerful. He said, "I will not run in Georgia and fight in Vietnam. I will not run from white people in Georgia and fight another ethnic group, Asians, in Vietnam." That's what he was trying to say. And there were problems, of course, in Vietnam. There were drug problems, there were problems of theft. A lot of soldiers got in trouble. And so the Army had this jail bit built, LBJ, and the black soldiers would say that stands for Lyndon B. Johnson, same initials.
The Long Dinh. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yes, the Long Dinh jail. At one point, there was a 9-day uprising staged by black prisoners. There was one white prisoner killed when it happened. The U.S. Army was able to keep it out of the news media. There were stories about it only after it ended. It was a racial rebellion in the armed services in Vietnam. It was awful. It was shocking. It was terrifying. And it was just awful. It was part of, as the book title says, it was part of the war within a war.
The book is The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. The author is my guest, Will Haygood. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. So you write about particular people. I think there's 8 or 9 of them that you profile. There's a doctor, the first black prisoner of war, a man named Fred Cherry. His story is particularly poignant and sad. You write about a concert pianist, a woman named Philippa Schuyler, who actually died in a helicopter crash trying to save orphans in Vietnam, many of whom were fathered by black soldiers. She took a particular interest in that. You also write about a guy named Lavelle Merritt, who was a major in 1968, right in the middle of the war that began in about 65 and didn't end until the fall of Saigon back in 1975. But he goes to the press briefing room in Saigon and hands out a statement, which reads in part, "The American military services are the strongest citadels of racism on the face of the earth." So he was putting front and center and elevating, you know, an assertion of horrific treatment of minority soldiers in the military, even those who were fighting this war. Was it widespread, the expressions of opposition and the expressions of frustration among the black military class, the black military officers, and black military soldiers? How would you summarize it?
Those officers who wanted to move up the ladder certainly did not do and what Mr. Merritt did. He was eventually told that it would be in his best interest to resign from the military, which he did after maybe 17, 18 years of service. So he was very heartbroken, but he really put his career on the line at that moment. He shocked military officials. He lost his career. And he went home. He went home. And it was very sad.
Tell us about Fred Cherry, an Air Force pilot who had to parachute out of his jet over North Vietnam and ended up in a prison, the Hau Lo prison in Hanoi. He was the 43rd American to be taken prisoner of war, but the first African American to be taken as a prisoner. How long was he imprisoned, and did he make it home?
He spent 5 years in prison. The North Vietnamese, with their thinking, thought that if they put Fred Cherry in a cell with a white Southerner, that they would kill each other. It was Porter Halliburton who was Fred Cherry's cellmate, a black man and a white man. The North Vietnamese, of course, knew about the racial struggles in the USA, and they thought that Halliburton and Fred Cherry would fight each other to the death. They didn't. They flipped the thinking, and they saved each other's life. When one would get tortured, the other would help him heal, would help heal his wounds. When one felt at his lowest point that he couldn't go on, the other would help him out. And they really saved each other's lives. And it's one of the beautiful stories in the book. Even though, Tom, there were so many racial stories there was also beautiful stories. I don't know, maybe call it forced brotherhood, but it was a brotherhood. It took war, it took blood, and it took guts to bring blacks and whites together more intimately than they would have been in the USA. We were just coming out of hardcore segregation in this country, and it was just tough. It was just tough to go into a city and to see blacks and whites, aside from entertainment and sports, just to see blacks and whites together in this country. It was...
Sure. And you quote Fred Cherry, who certainly was well aware of the dynamics of the fact that he was a black soldier being held and tortured by the North Vietnamese. He said that he prayed that the blacks of America knew that he was holding on, because he said, "I was fighting for 23 million black folks. That was my battle." And I found that really poignant. But also, when he came home, his wife had assumed he was dead and remarried. What a nightmare when he did survive it somehow, and then he comes home to find out that not only is the societal pressures of being a black man in America were still very much in force, but his personal life was in shambles as well. Just a very sad story.
Very sad. He wanted to fly. He had won medals. But he got back home after 5 years, and the Air Force wouldn't let him fly anymore because of his arm. He had a bad arm that had been mangled. His marriage was over with. But it's very interesting, Tom. He spoke to an audience, mixed race audience, after he got back. And he stood up there. He was being honored that night. And he said, because I love this country more than it has sometimes loved me, for your freedom, I would do it all over again. Yeah. People welled up with tears. People welled up with tears. Because of you, I would do it all over again.
Tell us in our last couple of minutes here about Wallace Terry, a reporter for Time magazine who published a book in the 1980s, in 1984, about his interviews with black soldiers and black military personnel.
Yes, yes. Wallace Terry was one of the first black correspondents in Vietnam. He was at Time magazine. He knew that there was racial friction over there when he landed. He was black. He met a lot of black soldiers. He wanted to write a book about the black soldier in Vietnam.
Yeah, we should, you know, mention, of course, he was one of the very few black journalists in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one was covering this kind of stuff. Sure.
Right. No. And so he had some oral histories, and he turned that into a book, and that's called Bloods, an oral history of the black soldier in Vietnam. It was his first book, but there has never been a nonfiction book about the black soldier experience in Vietnam. And so that's the kind of book I've written. And I traveled around the country 5 years talking to veterans, black and white men and women. There are three major female characters in this book. I love the Wallace Terry story. It's a great story. And I had an opportunity to talk to his wife, his widow, who recently passed away. Yes, his story is a great story.
And in our last minute here, what are your thoughts about the current assault by the Trump administration on DEI in general, and certainly the achievements, accomplishments, and history of African-American soldiers in the military, changing names of forts and erasing things from the DOD website, having to do with Tuskegee or with any other part of black history in the military. What do you think about? What do you make of all that?
Tom, I think it's sad. I think it's very sad. I mean, you go back to the Civil War and you had, and it took Frederick Douglass to go to the White House to meet with Lincoln to tell him, please let the black man fight. Lincoln wobbled on it a bit at first, but then he said, you are right, Mr. Douglass, the Union can't win with an all-white army. And 200,000 blacks volunteered. So there's a long history of blacks in their patriotism to aid this country. Blacks in World War I had to go to France to fight with the Allies over there because Americans' military leaders did not want blacks fighting in World War I. And those blacks, Harlem Hellcats and others who went to France to fight on behalf of America, they won a boatload of medals. And they proved their honor like so many soldiers did during the Vietnam War. And it's been a lost story, the saga of the black soldier in the Vietnam War, which is why I was so proud to tell it. And I'm going to be so proud to spend time with you very shortly in person.
Yeah, me too. I very much look forward to meeting you in person and having this conversation continue at the Pratt Library. Will Haygood, the book is called The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. Thanks so much, Will, and I'll see you Tuesday.
Thank you, Tom.
Will Haygood and I, again, will continue that conversation, that event Tuesday night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. Starts at 7 o'clock. And up next, midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review a new play at Baltimore Center Stage. We'll talk about Trinity right after this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.